The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, good evening, everybody. I am Stephen Reichlin, and it is a great pleasure and thrill to be here in Philadelphia. I've been coming to Philadelphia for, at least 47 years, because I have very dear relatives who are here, live here, and I used to take the train up from Baltimore. So I sort of feel like this is my second home. I'd like to do three things with you tonight. First of all, I'd like to take you on a tour of an amazing adventure that I took for the last 5 years, a trip around Planet Barbecue. And the second thing I'd like to do is I'd like to take you on an amazing journey through time, back to about 1.8 million years ago when our human ancestors first discovered the art of cooking meat over fire. And the third thing I'd like to do is kind of open up the room to the at the end of the talk to any questions you may have. Anything is fair game. I even answer questions from vegetarians. And in the course of my talk, I'd like to answer three questions tonight. And the first question is, what is Planet Barbecue? And the second question is, why does barbecue matter? And the third question is, how does a nice Jewish guy from Baltimore with a degree in French literature, how did he wind up spending 15 years of his life writing about barbecue? Anyway, first of all, let's start with a quick tour around Planet Barbecue. It is 7:30 p.m., and in Buenos Aires, Argentina, an asador, Argentinian grill master, is roasting whole lambs in front of a wood bonfire dish called and process called asado. Meanwhile, a Greek grill master has stuffed a farm-grown pig with garlic, lemon, oregano, trussed up and ready to spit roast over charcoal. Meanwhile, in South Africa, finally coming down from the high of the World Cup, an Afrikaans grill master is grilling a fish called snook. It manages to combine the deliciousness of swordfish with the buttery, oily consistency of bluefish, and it's glazed with an apricot garlic glaze. Meanwhile, in India, a kebabwala is cooking Sikh kebab and lamb kebabs over a charcoal fire. And he's gone kind of high-tech because you can see the fan he used to wave, by hand, has now been replaced with an electric fan to oxygenate the coals. Meanwhile, a grill mistress on the coast of Malaysia is slathering grouper with a fiery paste of chilies, galangale, lemongrass, the whole shebang to be wrapped in a banana leaf and grilled over charcoal. Note, by the way, she is a grill mistress. We have this misconception that grilling is a guy thing in North America. In fact, in much of the world, grilling is a gal thing. And throughout Southeast Asia, the Balkans, even in Mexico, most of the grill masters are actually grill mistresses. Finally, down under, a grilling enthusiast is using a North American import, a big green egg, to grill snags, which are called sausages, which what the Australians call sausages. And in North Carolina, a curmudgeon named Keith Allen is smoke roasting whole pork shoulders over oak embers. He'll chop these with dual cleavers to make a dish we know and love as pulled pork. Well, before we can talk about Planet Barbecue, we need to talk about what barbecue is. And for my purposes and in my books, I use five definitions for barbecue. So the first is a piece of equipment, the so-called barbecue grill. That is the original etymological meaning of the word barbecue. But the second meaning is a technique. Now, what I just showed you in this picture, let's see if that will work, is grilling. That is cooking small, tender, quick cooking pieces of food directly over a hot fire. This is about what 98% of the world does when it lights a grill, and what 98% of the world means when it speaks about barbecue. But for the other 2%, found primarily in North America, barbecue refers to a specific technique. That is cooking meats low and slow, that is over a low heat for a very long period of time, always in the presence of a lot of wood smoke. This device is called an offset barrel smoker. The firebox is actually down here, the smoke chamber here, and logs soaked so that they will emit plenty of smoke. For other people, barbecue is a particular dish. Do we have anyone here from Texas? Okay, well, if you were, I'd ask you what barbecue is. You'd say this, brisket. And by the way, please note on the edge of the brisket, you see this subcutaneous layer of pink around the edge? That is called the smoke ring. It's a naturally occurring chemical reaction that proves that you, as the pit master, have nailed it. I can see a few people know what I'm talking about here. Anybody here from Kansas City? Okay, I forget, in Philadelphia, probably most people here actually grew up here, but I come from Miami, and nobody comes from Miami except my wife. Anyway, if you come from Kansas City or Memphis, what barbecue means is ribs. So that's the third meaning, okay? That is a particular kind of dish, and it might be tri-tip in Santa Maria, California. It might be barbecued mutton in Owensboro, Kentucky. It might be barbecued oysters in Tamales Bay, California. So the fourth definition of barbecue is a meal that is cooked and eaten outdoors. And today we call a cooker for cooking true barbecue a pit, right? Talk about a pit. Well, the original barbecue pit actually was a pit. It was a trench dug in the ground, and the pigs were stretched across sticks over an ember-filled hole in the ground. That's how we got our word barbecue pit. The fifth definition of barbecue takes place out here, a public celebration. And in fact, in colonial America, when you talked about barbecues, that's what people thought about. It was a big communal party. So that's kind of a brief introduction to barbecue. And the next question I'd like to address is why barbecue matters. And I'd like to start by taking you back, way back, back about 3 million years, to a creature called Australopithecus. We know her better by the name of Lucy. And this was the first human ancestor to walk upright. Walking upright was a very big deal. Gave us a whole new perspective on life, a whole new way of moving around the world. But ultimately, Lucy had a very tiny brain, and she had giant jaws, giant teeth, because she ate her food raw, and she was basically a chewing machine. The next human ancestor to push our evolution forward was a creature called Homo habilis. That means handyman in Latin. Homo habilis emerged on the scene about 2.1 million years ago. And he discovered, or she, that you could take two rocks and pound them together. And if you did it at just the right angle with the right rock, you produce a sharp edge that could be used for cutting, butchering, scraping, killing. Homo habilis was the first tool maker. This was another major big step forward. However, evidence suggests that Homo habilis still ate his food raw. How do we know? If you look here on the top of the skull, there's a bony crest that's called the sagittal crest. Out here, these bony protuberances, they're called zygomatic arches. What they were, basically, were anchors for giant jaw muscles. Because if you observe primates in the wild, when they eat meat, they spend up to 6 hours a day chewing. Eating raw meat and raw food is a very inefficient process. Well, fast forward to this creature, I think one of the great unsung heroes of prehistoric history. His name was Homo erectus, upright man. And as you can see, he begins to look human. anthropologists actually use a test called the subway test. And that is, if an Australopithecus or a Homo habilis sat next to you in a subway, you probably would get up at the next stop and go to the go to another car. If Homo erectus sat next to you, you'd probably stay in the same car, and you'd probably wish he was on your rugby team. Homo habilis emerged about 1.8 million years ago. And he was the first of our prehistoric ancestors to cook meat with fire. Well, how did it happen? Probably by accident. I imagine a forest fire swept through the woods, cooked an auroch, which was a prehistoric steer, or a horse, or a bison on the hoof. Someone saw the carcass, someone tasted, someone uttered the first grunt of gastronomic pleasure in human history. Or perhaps an animal was trapped in a lava flow. In any case, by about 1.8 million BC, Homo erectus regularly used meat to cook fire. This is an imagined scene from a book called Dragon Bone Hill. Now, the act of cooking meat with fire, that is barbecue, had at least four profound effects on human evolution. And I must say, by the way, it's nice to be back in the North where I can use the E word, talk about evolution. Back when I was doing this down in the South, I kind of had to fast forward through this. Anyhow, so take a look. The first two important evolutionary changes were physiological. This we see Homo habilis, basically giant jaws, giant teeth, very small brain. Well, the first thing that happened is cooked meat is a heck of a lot easier to chew than raw meat. So the jaw shrunk in size, the teeth shrunk in size. And our mouths became smaller and more agile. This may have laid the groundwork for speech. The second thing that happened is, turns out about 20% of our caloric intake when we eat goes to fueling our brain. So cooked meat, much more efficient fuel, led to the rapid growth and expansion of the modern human brain. You could call barbecue the first brain food. The third change was actually a social change. And that is that when you observe primates in the wild, they tend to eat by themselves. But when everybody is gathered around a fire and cooking over a fire, we become social animals. We all have a focal point. We stare at each other. We look at each other. We communicate with each other. Eventually, we ask our neighbor to pass the salt or the mustard seed, which, by the way, are two seasonings that have been found at prehistoric campsites. Fourth thing that happens, also very important, is division of labor. Because the discovery of cooking meat with fire happened way before the discovery of actually learning how to make fire voluntarily. So basically, you had to have one set of people stay around the hearth, feed fresh wood, keep the fire going. And you had another group of people that went out, actually did the hunting, the gathering, the collecting of firewood. So we get a behavior that's pretty unique to the human species, and that is the division of labor. So all of these things together, the small jaw, the agile mouth, the increased brain size, the social organization, the division of labor, that led to one of the most effective human survival and thrival mechanisms, and that is speech and language. So you could truly say that barbecue begat civilization. No, seriously, folks, this whole kind of piece about the evolution stemmed from a question I've been thinking about for a while, which is, why are people so passionate about barbecue around the world? Because they really are. And whether you're a satay guy in Indonesia, or you're a braai master in South Africa, or an asador in South America, you feel this incredible passion. And I think fundamentally, it's not only that grilled and fire-cooked food tastes so good, it's also that we have this primal memory of this incredible invention, the most important invention of all of human history. Barbecue made us human. So it would take about another 500,000 years for us to learn how to make fire at will. But when we did, there was no stopping us. Now, two methods of making fire in prehistoric times. The first one demonstrated by a historical reenactor at the world's only Neanderthal theme park. It's called Préhisto Park in the southwest of France. The first method is called percussion. You strike two stones together. If one of them is flint and the other is a metallic stone like marcasite, you get a spark. And what this gentleman has done has been to place a little shredded tinder in this bird's nest of straw. Notice he has a piece of leather, auroch hide, on his lap to protect his leg from sparks. If you then take this wave it through the air, you will produce a fire. And this guy made a fire in about 60 seconds. So once you master the technology, it's incredibly effective. The other way that we made fire is using what's called the friction method, rubbing two sticks together. Now, if you've ever watched a reality show, you know that this is a little bit tougher than first meets the eye. But this is a professor of prehistoric anthropology from the University of Marseille. He does a lot of his research underwater, visiting caves that are underwater. That's why we're at the harbor side. But I wrote him and met him. And there's a spindle here and a little socket down here he fills with tinder, a bow that he rocks back and forth. It took him almost a decade to figure out the right combination of wood and tinder and the shape of the socket. But ultimately, he too produced a fire in about 1 minute. So once you learn this stuff, it's almost effective as lighting a butane match. Well, once we mastered fire with our increased brain size, our ability of language, the innovations came fast and furious. The cooperative hunt here pictured at Préhisto Park. And we even became good enough to hunt animals that were 10 times our size and that could take out a whole village with one slight swipe of its massive tusks. What these guys have done is dug a hole, covered it with thin sticks and branches, and then drove the animal on top of it until it fell in the hole. But however you hunted your animal, you cooked it in a method that we would recognize today at the end of a stick over a live fire. Well, I'd like to fast forward to kind of the next period of barbecue history. And for many of us here in this audience, barbecue is a religious experience. In ancient times, barbecue was actually inextricably interwoven with religion. For example, the ancient Greeks believed that the gift of fire was given to man by a god named Prometheus. And Prometheus paid a dear price for this gift. The other gods were so angry, they chained him to a rock and condemned him to have his liver eaten out alive every day. And here you can see the fennel stalk in which he hid the spark, and that's how he transferred fire to mankind. By the way, parenthetical note, there is a great painting of this in your art museum here in Philadelphia that I saw this afternoon. Well, in the ancient Greek literature, for example, in the Iliad of Homer, anytime there was a major battle, you got psyched up and appeased the gods by staging animal sacrifice, a.k.a. barbecue. And it looked something like this. A priest would set up an altar, bring the sacred cows to the altar, and then they would be sacrificed. And they would be put on a pyre. And in the Iliad, Homer actually describes taking the thigh meat, wrapping it in strips of fat, putting it on the fire, dousing it with olive oil and wine. The wine would have been retsina, right? Greek resin wine, placed in goatskin bags, the seams of which were sealed with pine resin. And I've actually made that recipe based on nothing more than two lines of Homer, and it's delicious. I know exactly what it tasted like. Now, animal sacrifice among the ancients had some convenient properties. And that is, in all of the religions, the part that the gods or God seemed to want were the horns and the skin and the hooves and the entrails. And the parts that was left over for the puny and insignificant humans was the meat. By the way, in ancient Jerusalem, circa 20 BC, one reporter cited more than 50,000 different animal sacrifices in the course of 1 year. So it was a big deal. Among the ancient Romans, barbecue was raised to the level of art. They gave us our first barbecue recipe. The author was a man named Apicius, and there's a restaurant named after him in Paris. This is a scene from a movie called The Satyricon. This hog has been spit-roasted on a wood-burning rotisserie, belly stuffed with cooked sausages. And the slave who serves it slices open the belly, and all these cooked sausages come rushing out. In Latin, the ancient Romans called the hearth on which they did their grilling, on which they did their grilling, the focus. It became the focal point of the house. And when your wife tells you to focus when she's talking to you, it's to pay attention to what's going on. And it also gave, the focus gave its name to a popular Italian bread called focaccia. Well, here's a more sinister side of barbecue as religion. This is St. Lawrence, and he met his end by being cooked alive on a barbecue grill. And according to the lives of the saints, he told the people torturing him when one side was done to turn him over and cook the other side. Well, the third period in the history of barbecue is what I call the age of exploration, the age of discovery. This is an imagined scene on the island of Hispaniola. Today we know it as Dominican Republic in Haiti. The year was 1514. The character, the historic figure, was a guy named Gonzalo Fernando Oviedo y Valdez. He had landed a job to run a gold mine in Colombia, which back in the 16th century was sort of like working for Goldman Sachs, as today. It's interesting, I gave this talk in New York City last night. Nobody laughed at that particular joke. Anyway, unlike the more rapacious of his colleagues, he was very interested in the foodways and the culture of the locals. So these are Taino Indians, and they, they gave us the canoe. That's a Taino Indian word. And they gave us the hammock. That is a Taino Indian word. You see here using a spindle to light a fire. Somewhere in this picture there ought to be some tobacco, because that was a Taino Indian word. But the most important Taino Indian word was this. Gonzalo came across Taino Indians cooking fish and wild game over an apparatus that looked like this. He asked, what's it called? They answered, barbacoa. At least that's what it sounded like to the Spanish ear. And barbacoa became our word barbecue. Now, I'd like to call your attention to a couple of interesting things in this early depiction of barbecue. One, the grill grate is wood. When your grill grate is wood, what do you have to do? Have it high above the fire so that sticks won't catch fire. When you do that, what do? You lower the heat, you increase the wood smoke. So even back in the Taino Indian days, barbacoa implied low, slow, and smoky. Well, Gonzalo came back to Spain, published his findings in this book, General History of the Indies, in 1526. I gave this talk at the Library of Congress a few years ago, and they invited me into the Rare Books Room and put this volume in my lap, and it had it open to the page where the first written word, barbacoa, appeared. It was really cool. And I'd like to fast forward to Boston Beach, Jamaica, which is the epicenter of a Jamaican barbecue specialty called jerk. Traditional way to make jerk It's cooked on sticks of allspice wood, okay, over the embers. So 400 years later, at least one Caribbean culture is still grilling on a wooden barbacoa. Well, this is a scene from my home state, Florida, circa 1550. It was a Huguenot settlement in what is now near St. John's, Florida. And I love this slide because it kind of shows what they imagined people were grilling. So that's an alligator. That's supposed to be an alligator. I think that's a deer. And that is supposed to be an Everglades serpent of some sort. Again, you see the wood smoke, the fan for oxygenating the fire. The way these illustrations would work is the explorers make little pen and ink sketches in their notebooks. And they'd go back to professional engravers in Europe who then would turn the images into artwork. But this guy, having never seen an alligator, took a giant leap of imagination. A more sinister barbecue, this one portraying a barbecue in Brazil in the 1550s. And actually, this may look like a culinary depiction, but it was really a piece of political propaganda. By labeling the natives of the New World cannibals, Europeans could justify brutal treatment that included slavery and murder and extermination of a whole people. Another little-known aspect of early Caribbean barbecue. The natives of what is now Haiti had a technique that was called boucané. And boucan was the local word for smoke. It's actually still used in Caribbean French and in French-Canadian French. And they would use it for preserving meats, smoke-preserving meat, and also, more sinisterly, for preserving corpses, mummifying corpses. What you did is you laid animal skins over a fire, and that generated the smoke. There was a group of Europeans. They tended to be runaway sailors, runaway slaves, pirates, good-for-nothings, who gathered on the north coast of Haiti. They went native. They adopted the style of boucané, of smoke-cooking meats, and they became known as buccaneers. Well, moving forward to the colonial period, George Washington was a major fan of barbecue, writes about it in his diaries all the time. One barbecue in Alexandria, Virginia lasted 3 days. In fact, George Washington only lost one election. It was for a house in the seat of Burgess. And one commentator of the period observed that he lost the election because he neglected to provide the customary refreshments. That is, he forgot to stage a barbecue. Barbecues were an integral part of public life in colonial America. When the British surrendered in Yorktown, barbecues were staged throughout the land. When the cornerstone of the Capitol building in the fledgling Washington, D.C. was laid, a huge barbecue was staged on what would eventually become the National Mall. And actually, I love the technology of this. It's spit roasting a whole ox, an act which, by the way, is documented throughout visual history. There's one engraving I have from Germany where they cut slits in the ox and then they inserted rabbits and chickens and ducks to kind of roast the whole thing together. But anyway, reflectors on the bottom with live coals and then a pan in the center that gathered the drippings for basting. Abraham Lincoln, another American president with deep roots in barbecue, when his parents were married, their wedding feast was a barbecue. The menu has been preserved, and we know that the main course were sheep that were grilled over wood, and then they placed branches under the meat at the last minute. So the leaves, the spruce leaves, the pine leaves, would perfume the meat. A technique which, by the way, is still used in Quebec and Canada today. But the other important thing that Abraham Lincoln did was emancipated the slaves. And by emancipating the slaves, he created a new generation and a new breed of commercial pitmaster. For the first time in America, You had people who would cook barbecue for money, and you had places where you could go when you felt like eating barbecue, and you could pay for it. Well, one of the descendants of these early pitmasters was a man named Mr. Henry Perry. He opened the first barbecue joint in Kansas City. And among his employees was a guy named Arthur Bryant. And Arthur Bryant went on to become probably the most famous pitmaster in Kansas City. The next chapter of American barbecue, it's what I call American barbecue comes home. And it began with none other than the industrialist Henry Ford. Now, Henry Ford had a problem, and that is, in the manufacture of the Model T Ford, he had lots of wood scraps left over. And being the good industrialist that he was, he had no interest in wasting all these wood scraps. So he learned about a process whereby you could grind up the wood with coal dust, petroleum binders, borax, sand, pound it into a pillow-shaped briquette, and thereby making the charcoal briquette. And he started a company called the Ford Charcoal Briquette Company. I haven't heard of it either. It sort of teetered along until he sold it to a relative who was a timberman. And the relative's last name was Kingsford. And the rest, as they say, is history. So, we need a couple of other elements before we arrive at modern barbecue. And the first is the suburbs, made accessible by the advent of the interstate highway system after World War II. And finally, actually by suburbs, like this early portrayal of Levittown, where finally vast numbers of Americans, GIs coming back from World War II, could have backyards. So we've got the fuel. We've got the backyard where you can do your grilling for your family. Enter this gentleman, and I'm actually talking about this gentleman. His name was George Stevens, and he worked for a company that made nautical buoys. He worked out of Palatine, Illinois. And he had the idea to take the bottom half of a nautical buoy and put legs on it, cut vent holes in the bottom. Then he had the idea to take a piece of the top half and weld a handle on it, put more vent holes on it. And the company he worked for was called the Weber Metalworks Company. And what, in fact, he had created was the Weber Kettle Grill. Okay? So, finally, we've got the backyard, we've got the fuel, we've got the grill. Next thing I'd like to talk to you about, so at any rate, to just sort of wrap up that phase of the talk, why does barbecue matter? Well, it matters because the invention of cooking meat over fire did nothing less than make us human. Okay, so that's why barbecue matters. Let's go back to Planet Barbecue a little bit. All right, so first of all, if you come from North Carolina, this is what barbecue looks like. If you come from Munich, Germany, barbecue might be this, giant ham hocks seasoned with juniper berries, a medieval herb, an herb used widely in the Middle Ages called mugwort, salt and pepper, and roasted on this ingenious vertical rotisserie. Or if you're in Bali, Indonesia, barbecue might mean babi guling, a whole pig stuffed with an explosive array of Southeast Asian herbs and roasted over a wood fire on a hand-turned rotisserie. Or back to Jamaica, barbecue might mean this, jerk. We talked about the wooden allspice grate. Two other things make jerk jerk. One is the fiery paste of Scotch bonnet chilies, allspice berries, cinnamon, and escallions. And the other is a very interesting technique whereby the meat is butterflied in an accordion cut so that no piece of meat is thicker than 2 inches. And all the meat, this is basically one giant, big, salty, fiery, smoky crust. Okay? They've eliminated the center of the meat. This actually, earlier this morning, started as a whole hog, and the way you know is here's the tail. Let's see, further afield in Singapore and Malaysia, pork is mixed with sugar, rose water, hoisin sauce to make a sort of grilled pork jerky called bakwa. By the way, all these recipes are in the book, by coincidence. And in Hungary, perhaps the apotheosis of pork eating, this is grilled bacon. You grill it over a wood fire. You let the fat drip onto a piece of grilled rye bread spread with thinly sliced onions and tomatoes. It's the quickest and most delicious way to a heart attack there is. But on much of Planet Barbecue, the meat of choice is not pork or beef, but lamb. In fact, I'd say on any given night, more people are grilling lamb than any other meat. This is a scene in Azerbaijan, Baku, Azerbaijan. A chef, I call this guy the Emerald of Azerbaijan. By the way, Azerbaijan is an oil-rich country that borders the Caspian Sea. It's in the Caucasus Mountains. And it's interesting because it's one of the few Arab countries that actually has good relations with Israel. I found myself stranded there on Rosh Hashanah a few years ago and went to an incredible service, and the Israeli ambassador was there. The cooking device, very interesting. If you know Indian food, you know about the tandoor. That's the upright barbecue pit. Well, this is called a tandir, and it's the Azeri version. Chickens hanging from the skewer, the skewers in the tandir. By the way, my workaround, if you don't have a tandir, is to use the beer can chicken technique for cooking the chickens upright. And of course, burgers are a great part of the barbecue experience. The world's largest burger is this. It's called a pletskavica, and it comes from the Balkans, where it's made with a mixture of veal, beef, and pork, sometimes veal, beef, and lamb. In Korea, eel is one of the preferred foods for barbecuing. It's lacquered a dozen times with a sweet, salty soy glaze until it looks like something like this. And in the Caribbean, barbecue might feature spiny lobster. In Greece, no barbecue would be complete without octopus. And in Southeast Asia, grill masters will actually cook eggs in the shell over a charcoal fire. Here's a grilled dish from Spain that you can eat both for breakfast and dessert. It's grilled bread sandwiched with chocolate, brushed with olive oil, and seasoned with coarse sea salt. And in India, speaking of grilled bread, here's the tandoor, the underground pit rolls, which are going to be turned into an Indian bread called naan. This was actually a scene taken from the Primal Grill TV show, airing hopefully on TV station here in Philly. From Thailand, lengths of bamboo are filled with sticky rice and actually laid right in the fire. The rice is roasted in the bamboo, which gives it an incredible nutty, smoky flavor. And in Brazil, a grilled dessert, whole pineapple dusted with cinnamon sugar, spit roasted on the rotisserie. But grilled desserts are a big thing around Planet Barbecue. This is a crema catalana, what we would call a creme brulee, where the sugar is placed on top of the custard. A fire-heated poker heated right on the burning logs, which gives you a smoky flavor, and then used to caramelize the sugar on top. There's a close-up. And in Thailand, grilled bananas basted with coconut caramel sauce. This lady plies her pushcart behind the Sheraton Royal Orchid Hotel next time you're in Thailand. She's been written up by guidebooks all over the world. Totally fantastic experience. And the most singular dessert, back to Baku, Azerbaijan, this is grilled ice cream. And what the chef did is took balls of ice cream, dipped them in beaten egg, then in shredded coconut, on a metal skewer over a screaming hot fire, cooked quickly enough to seal the egg mixture and make a crust, but not so long that you melt the ice cream. Well, one of the interesting things about Planet Barbecue is that we do it differently everywhere. And I sort of have a theory, and that is that every culture invents the barbecue that best suits its natural resources, its social organization, and even its religious beliefs. So in Asia, barbecue tends to be small. I say, I always call Asian barbecue the barbecue of good things in small packages. This is a scene in Nha Trang, Vietnam. The grill is called a bucket grill. It actually fits on your table, so you get your meal cooked to order. You can even cook it by yourself. Mixed grill Vietnamese style is a couple mouthfuls of squid, beef, and whole prawn. And here's another example. This was the single most expensive grilled dish I had on Planet Barbecue, a restaurant called Inakaya, dinner for two, $430. Totally amazing. These are tiny, high-tech gas grills. So that sort of adds new perspective to the gas versus charcoal debate. And all the food is served on these long paddles with a lot of shouting. That's because this style of grilling was said to originate with Japanese fishermen who served the meal on the oars of their fishing boats. Satay, the tiny kebab of Southeast Asia. Here's the Malaysian version, and it's considered good manners to eat about 20 of these. In North America, just the opposite situation took place. That is, we had vast forests, enormous amount of fuel to burn, not a whole lot of people. We evolved a style of grilling that took advantage of smoke and fire, relative simple flavors. This is a Pacific Northwest Indian salmon roast, what Lewis and Clark would have seen when they reached the mouth of the Columbia River. We like our barbecue big in North America. This is a giant pig-shaped smoker at the Memphis and May International Barbecue Contest. And, of course, we like big hunks of meat. This guy is Rich Davis, a child psychiatrist turned barbecue mogul. He had a family recipe for a sweet smoky barbecue sauce that he called Casey Masterpiece. Sold it for $10 million to Clorox. In India, spice is king. No surprise there. India is a major spice producer, also a major spice root stop. So any given dish in India would be marinated in a garlic water or ginger water and a yogurt and spice mixture. Grilled Indian barbecue characterized by these lurid colors. This is a pushcart behind the Taj Mahal Hotel, where if you come late at night, you'll find movie stars, politicians. Flavor matters much more than fancy in India. Finally, South America, a scene from Colombia where an animal called chiguero, sort of a giant guinea pig, is roasted on sticks over an open eucalyptus fire. Similar technique down in Brazil called fogo de chão, campfire, whole sides of beef rotated on a rotisserie in front of the fire. Interesting scene from Cambodia, where I had one of my most memorable barbecue experiences. This is an engraving from a 12th century temple, and it shows how the meat would be put in a split skewer and cooked over a fire. And this is 800 years later exactly how they do it. This stick will be held over a brazier filled with live charcoal. One of the things that never fails to amaze me and delight me about Planet Barbecue is the sheer ingenuity that goes into grilling. This is a scene from Marrakesh, Morocco. And if you look closely, his grill grate is the cooling coil from the back of a refrigerator. Another ingenious grill, this is called a Schwenkbraten, a swinging grill from Germany. And it has a fan positioned to the spindle. So when the fire heats up, it turns the fan, which turns the grill. This is a wood-burning grill, and by spinning the grate, you equalize the heat and the fire. Another ingenious grill, this one from probably the most innovative grill restaurant in the world. It's called Estabari in Spain. It's a grill designed to let you place charcoal both above and below the food, to kind of grill in between it. This guy, by the way, Victor Arguinaziz, the sort of guy that smokes the butter that he spreads on his grilled bread and smokes the cream to make ice cream. And you'll find that recipe in the book as well. Ingenious oiling technique. You all know how I say keep it hot, clean, and lubricated. Okay, great way to oil a grill grate in Israel. Half onion dipped in vegetable oil, rubbed across the bars of the grate. Very ingenious technique from Korea. Now, Koreans use tiny grills in the center of the table. So how the heck do you cook a beef rib? Well, you cut it into a small piece, you butterfly it open into a paper-thin sheet, you direct grill it over live charcoal, and then to serve it, you place it on a lettuce leaf with hot sauce and pickles and rice. You roll it up and pop it in your mouth. This is barbecue, by the way. It's health food, predominance of plant foods, just a little bit of meat as a condiment. Another ingenious grill, a vertical rotisserie in Mexico, used to make a dish called tacos al pastor, pork marinated and flavored with chili. It's carved under a tortilla, and then the grill master will take a little piece of grilled pineapple, flick it over his head onto the waiting tortilla, and serve the taco al pastor to you. Hand turning the handles for kebab skewers in Marrakesh, Morocco. One way to prevent fish from sticking to the grill grate in Greece, grill it on fig leaves. Another way from the bush in Australia, stuff it with bush herbs like lemon myrtle, wrap it in paper bark, a very thin bark from a tree, grill it in the bark, the paper bark chars, the fish gets an incredible smoke flavor, holds together, and doesn't stick to the grate. A great technique from Colombia, Bogota, Colombia, take a piece of beef tenderloin, place it on a damp cloth with salt and oregano, tie the whole thing up in a bundle, place it directly on the embers, a style I call caveman grilling, and crack the whole shebang open to reveal the most succulent piece of beef tenderloin you'll ever taste. By the way, this is a dish where just hearing about it once was enough to prompt me to make a trip to Colombia to experience it. Another ingenious dish, this one from the Ile de Ré on the west coast of France. Mussels in a perforated metal pan filled with dry pine needles. And you place the pan over the fire. The pine needles catch fire and smoke the mussels open. It's a one-ingredient dish, one of the two or three best things I've ever eaten in my life. Salt grilling, a technique found throughout the world of barbecue, wherein you place fistfuls of salt on the steak, grill it, and then just before serving, turn the steak on its side, whack it with the knife to whack the salt off. What comes off is a steak that is incredibly flavorful, great crust, but nonetheless will not give you hypertension. Another version of salt grilling, picanha in Brazil. A very interesting way to serve barbecue in South Africa is called buy and braai. You go to a butcher stop and you buy the particular kind of meat you feel like eating. This is pork shoulder cut into quarter-inch thin slices. And then you go out in front of the restaurant and the butcher shop has provided a grill, public grill, for anybody that buys the meat to cook their own with. No talk about Planet Barbecue would be complete without shish kebab, from the Turkish words shish, meaning sword, kebab, meaning meat. Here is a sampling of Turkish shish kebabs, and notice that each is on a different shaped or width skewer, so the grillmaster can tell which one is which. Turks have devised a very ingenious method of grilling. When we make shish kebab, what do? We put the meat next to the onion, next to the tomato, next to the mushroom, next to the pepper, with the net result that the onion is always raw, the tomato always overcooks and falls off, the meat stews because it's sandwiched with the vegetables. And what they like to do in Turkey is they keep the meat separate, the pepper separate, the tomatoes separate. This is sort of an interesting dish. It's actually slices of eggplant with ground lamb in between. But by dividing and conquering, you can cook your onions, your peppers, your tomatoes to the exact degree of doneness you need. And everything comes out cooked perfectly. This is a great Kurdish restaurant in Istanbul, a sort of a cross between a shish kebab joint and a sushi bar. You cook your own. And I actually at the end of this interview was put in front of a camera and asked, given some text in Kurdish that said something like, I, Stephen Reichlin, find Kurdish barbecue extremely delicious. And that's how I wound up on Kurdish television in Istanbul. Just a few of the more unusual items that I found on Planet Barbecue. This is grilled foie gras in Israel. Grilled fish mousse in a banana leaf that I found in Malaysia. The other red meat, grilled kangaroo in Australia. Grilled cuttlefish in Manila in the Philippines, stuffed with lemongrass. And the single most unusual dish on Planet Barbecue, a Greek dish called kokoretsi. It consists of brains, lungs, liver, spleen, testicles of sheep, threaded on this long ramrod-like spit, the whole shebang wrapped in small intestine, and cooked on a charcoal rotisserie. You could think of it as haggis on a spit. And it's actually pretty good. I did clean my plate on this one, unlike the coagulated chicken blood rectangles that I had in the Philippines. Those go by the name of Betamax. So, folks, it's been about 1.8 million years since our human ancestors first discovered barbecue. And yet the passion and deliciousness of live fire cooked foods continues to move us today. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So what I'd like to do now is just kind of open the floor to questions. So does anybody have a question? Yes, ma'am. Okay, let's wait for the microphone.
I've read that you're classically trained in the culinary arts. Can you tell us what was your path to barbecue passion?
Okay, that's a great question. The question, well, I think everybody heard it right. And that sort of answer, we talked about what is Planet Barbecue and why barbecue matters. That's the third question, how's a guy with a degree in French literature wind up kind of writing about barbecue as I do. And the short version is this. I got a degree in French literature. And then when I graduated, I won a Watson Foundation fellowship. Tom Watson founded IBM. And in a night fueled by Retsina wine, I proposed to study medieval cooking in Europe. And amazingly, the Watson Foundation bought it. And I got to go to Europe and eat and drink my way through Europe studying the intersection of food, culture, and history, which I did for 18 months. While in Europe, because I argued to the foundation that I really couldn't write about medieval cooking if I didn't understand modern French cooking, I went to the Laveran Cooking School. So that's sort of the classical training part. Came back to the United States, became the wine and spirits editor for GQ magazine, then the restaurant critic for Boston magazine, then developed a cholesterol problem, then started writing a series of books called High Flavor, Low Fat Cooking. Then Lipitor was invented, and that cleared the way for writing about barbecue, which I started. Thank you. I started in 1994. Then finally, Barbecue Bible went into French a few years ago. So I went to Montreal because I had this degree in French literature. I did a book tour in French. And that led to a phone call from a TV producer asking me if I'd like to do a French language barbecue TV show. And I said, sure, this is really going to happen with an American. And 9 months later, I was on the set of what became called Le Maître du Grill, the grill master, or the master of the grill. So, yes, Dad, 30 years later, I did prove that a degree in French literature can finally pay off. Anyway, that's sort of the short version. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Hang on, I think we got a mic. By the way, when you ask a question, tell us your name, where you're from, and last four digits of your social.
My name is Jonathan Mathis. I was just curious whether or not the information inside your book and apparently on the website science and various other places, will be shared openly with people, and in that sharing, will barbecue evolve past what has currently become a fad of microwaving, which I don't think is going to last all that long compared to barbecue.
Well, okay, so that's a good question. So I think if I understand correctly, you're asking sort of where is barbecue headed? Because we just looked for where barbecue was. And I see great things on the horizon for barbecue. I mean, first of all, already proven trends, multiple grill ownerships. About 35% of American families now own more than one grill. Grilling the entire year, about 32% of Americans, even if they live in the Northeast, grill year-round. Globalization of the American grill, we see it already, right? We're very comfortable with Indian tandoori, with Japanese teriyaki, with Brazilian steakhouses. That's going to continue. The broadening of what we consider barbecue. When I was growing up, barbecue was that burnt hunk of meat in the center of the plate. Well, today we smoke roast the potatoes. We grill the polenta. We grill the asparagus. We grill the appetizer. We grill the dessert. So cooking the entire meal on the grill. I think there are going to be some interesting, I think we're going to be kind of schizophrenic about the equipment. And on one level, we're going to sort of go back to our roots. And there's going to be a lot more grilling with wood. Some of you have seen on the show, I use a wood-burning grill that has a flywheel that raises and lowers the grate. That's a big seller. Wood-burning ovens, a big seller. At the same time, I think you're going to see more high-tech grills. You're going to see rotisseries. You already have where the food, you don't have to stick the spit through the food. There's sort of a metal basket that fits around it. I think you're going to see rotisseries, special dedicated rotisserie devices that do only spit roasting. I think you're going to see a lot more charcoal use. I think you're going to see a lot more wood and charcoal use. I think you're going to see what I do, because I'll admit it, 12-step program. I own a gas grill. I own several. I use them on busy weeknights. But I think you'll see people grilling on wood and charcoal on the weekends and maybe using gas. I think you're going to see the grill and the backyard become an extension of the kitchen. It already has with the outdoor kitchen and dining room. Where when I was growing up, grilling was sort of, you know, we would burn our meat once a week or once a month. And today, well, how many people grill more than three times a week in this audience? Sure. Good. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
3 parts. Where did you have dinner tonight? What's your favorite junk food? And throughout history, there have been people that have been tasters for politicians and kings. I'd like to apply.
Okay, well, let's see. First of all, where I had lunch is that's the most important thing first. And it's at Carmine's in Reading Terminal Market. That's what you call it, right? The market? Yeah. And I think, personally, he has the best, the real Italian or the Italian special. I think it's the best hoagie in Philadelphia. I've been going there for at least 30 years. Where I had dinner? Where do we have dinner tonight?
Aya's,
which is a North African Middle Eastern restaurant around the corner. Very charming. Third question was about tasting, being a taster.
Junk food,
my favorite junk food. I'm not a big junk food guy. I never eat fast food, which I think is sort of a cancer on the land. Probably pretzels, that's sort of, and my other sort of slumming food is cinnamon graham crackers with milk, and you kind of make a mush out of it. But don't tell my wife I told you that. Great. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
We recently moved back here from the South, South Carolina and Georgia, and obviously barbecue was pretty popular down there. And there's a few restaurants here now that are starting barbecue. Do you see it moving pretty seriously up in the Northeast?
Oh, yeah, I see it all over the country. Used to be that barbecue was truly regional. And, you know, to this extent today, I mean, nobody's doing tri-tip except people on the West Coast, California. Pulled pork pretty much become a national dish. Brisket become a national dish. Kansas City-style ribs become a national dish. You know, New York underwent a barbecue revolution about 3 years ago with the opening of places like Rub and Hill Country and Daisy Mays. And I'm not surprised to hear that's happening here, and I think that'll continue. By the way, next trend for my trend seeker out there, any budding chefs, Asian barbecue. I think there's a big play with Asian barbecue. Any other questions?
How do you do? My name is Anthony, and I'm from Mobile, Alabama. And around Christmas time, we usually put like turkey on the grill. Like, we really try to start barbecuing turkey. What would you say would be the best thing, in your opinion, grill around Christmas time?
Well, let's see. Actually, being Jewish, what we do on Christmas time is we go out for Chinese food. But no, I'm sorry. I was just kidding, because that's a very serious question, and I have some important thoughts on it. And turkey would be my second choice, because that's what we do for Thanksgiving. We always cook our turkey on the grill. But I'm a little bit of an iconoclast, and that is I prefer to indirect grill a turkey at a higher temperature, 350, with wood smoke, rather than low and slow true barbecue turkey. Because I find when you low and slow true barbecue turkey, the skin becomes very rubbery. Whereas when you work at a higher temperature, and if there might be a basting of butter on the skin, it never hurts, you wind up with crisp skin. The other thing I do with holiday turkey is always brine it. It's a salt, brown sugar, bourbon brine. So good question. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Jeanette, and I grew up in Oklahoma.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. We really do have some... Yeah.
Everything went on the grill that crossed my mother's yard.
Okay.
We used to chase a lot of animals out the yard because we didn't want them for dinner.
Uh-huh.
I really watch the show every day.
Yeah.
1:30 in Jersey.
Wow.
1:00 in Jersey. And I want to know where you're going to take the show now.
Okay.
Where's the show going to go from now?
Oh.
To me, you've done just about everything. Where are you going to go now?
Okay, that's a great question. Well, so first of all, we're going to do one more year of Primal Grill, and it's going to be kind of focused on the international recipes from Planet Barbecue. And this year, if you've seen the show, we went behind the scenes to show you how we put the show together. We're going to do a lot more of that. We are also simultaneously working on a documentary on the history of barbecue, where I will not cook, but I will talk and interview. And we're simultaneously fundraising to turn Planet Barbecue the book into Planet Barbecue the TV show. So that's sort of the big things on my agenda. Good. Great question. Take just a couple more. Yes, ma'am. I was wondering how you got from that side to that side so quickly. The two of you.
Grill.
Thank you.
And we love it. And just a question. One of the episodes had you do jalapeno poppers, and there was a piece of equipment you used for that. Where did you... we've never heard of it or seen it. Where did you get it?
So the jalapeno popper, if there are any of you older enough to think of poppers as something different, what these are... by the way, did you see that the lead singer of the Fugs died last week? Anyway... But jalapeno popper, it's a hollowed out jalapeno pepper stuffed with cheese wrapped in bacon, indirect grilled or smoke roasted. The device is actually a device that I designed and created. It's a jalapeno pepper popper rack. And afterwards, I'm going to give you a little little certificate to the website where you can buy those. But you can also lay them on your side, and that recipe is in Primal Grill as well. Great. Did you ask another question? There was another thought, but I kind of forgot what it was. Okay. Yeah.
I have another question in reference to smoking. I'm a barrel smoker.
Yeah.
And I guess really, in general, for smoking, how many wood chunks do you use? Like, I see the growing a lot.
Okay. What you're describing is what I call the guy syndrome. The guy syndrome says, if some is good, more is better. Tablespoon of Tabasco sauce and a sauce is good, so therefore a half a bottle must be better. In general, I use about 3/4 cup of wood chips or 2 or 3 chunks of wood per side in an indirect grilling situation. per hour. And when I'm cooking a big piece of meat, I smoke only the first half of the cooking time. Brisket for the first 6 hours, not smoke the second 6 hours. Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah.
Saturday.
Yes.
At the hour, I was one of the first to get here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
My brother's a professional chef, and I texted him while you were listening. While I was listening to you, he told me that he knew you personally. He had he's a barbecue, national barbecue spokesperson.
Okay.
But my question is that I'm, for the first time, going to be cooking for about 200 people. And not to mention on Saturday. So you're invited, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Actually, I've been on the road for 2.5 months, and I'm going to actually be home on Saturday, but that's the only thing that keeps me from not going to your place.
I actually feel very prepared because I've like studied everything. I've recorded everything you got, and I've gotten your book, and I've tried to organize everything as well as possible. I do have my own barbecue sauce recipe.
Okay.
So my question directly is that I'm, for the first time, thinking about roasting the green peppers, the red peppers, and the onions that I use. I want to smoke them first, as opposed to cooking them down in olive oil.
Great idea. Excellent idea. By the way, I have a question for you. I see two empty hands. I'm wondering where the little thermos is or the little bottle with your barbecue sauce. Oh, okay. I'll tell you what. We'll just take a couple more. And if you have, let's try and focus on people who maybe haven't asked the question. Okay.
I'm John Shepard.
Yeah.
When you're on the TV, you have a collection of a dozen or more grills around the center. If you had to recommend a single grill, let's leave smokers out of the equation. If you had to recommend a single grill configuration as the most versatile available, what would you recommend?
Super easy. It is the Weber Performer. It's a 22.5-inch kettle grill built into a cart with a gas ignition system. So for anybody who ever belly aches, they don't have time to light the charcoal, you know what? With the push of the button, you light the charcoal very easily. I own them every place I go, and if I could only have one, that is where it would go. Let's see. By the way, Matt, would you stand up for a minute? And actually, come on down here for a minute. It turns out that the producer of Primal Grill is in the audience tonight, Matt Cohen from Resolution Pictures. Hey, buddy.
Hey, Stephen.
Okay. So now you can ask, you have any questions about the show. You know where I thought he was going with that, Matt?
I thought
he was going to say, with everybody emails, what's in the, what is actually in those? Are those empty and are you just wasting fuel and polluting the environment? So actually the party line is that we cook the staff meals in
those. That's right. Sometimes they're empty and we waste fuel. Sometimes we cook food in them. And right. Stephen made sure that we would always show one thing being cooked in them just in case that question was asked.
Very good. All right. We'll take one more question. Thank you, Matt. And by the way, bravo to Matt because he works very hard.
And I'm his stand-in, you can tell, right?
Good. Any other questions? We'll take one more. Yes, ma'am.
So now we live in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Mm. So where do we go to get barbecue?
Well, do you have a terrace? You get yourself a large hibachi and you cook on your terrace. But first give plenty of food to your neighbors so they don't complain. Great. All right, folks. Well, I'll tell you what. Thank you. You've been a lovely audience. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. And right now I'm going to do, I guess, what my doctor calls... Assuming the position, I'll be outside to sign some books.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.